T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again today. Really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about today, including what type of flu season we might have this year and the prospect for it coming up against COVID-19. We'll also discuss the need for colon cancer screening, and we'll find out about the dangers posed by some hand sanitizers. But first, let's get the show started the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, it's always my pleasure, Fred.
Lots of talk this past week about face coverings and about a possible vaccine timeline. Let's talk about both, beginning with face masks. These comments were made this past week by CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield.
These face masks are the most important, powerful public health tool we have. If we did it for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, we'd bring this pandemic under control. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine, because the immunogenicity may be 70%. And if I don't get an immune response, the vaccine's not going to protect me. This face mask will.
Dr. Buchholz, tell us what you're learning about face masks.
Well, I think the big thing about this is I always think about things about asymmetric risk and benefit. Again, the downstream harms of wearing a face mask is, you know, your nose may itch a little bit, it's a little uncomfortable. But, you know, the upside is when you start to employ this on a large scale and people, you know, everybody is doing it, or the large percentage of the population is doing it, you have an effect. Look at New York City. I mean, New York City, you know, we all know in March going into April was just a complete and utter catastrophe. And, you know, after more rigorous policies are put in place and then, you know, really the implementation after that happened of the face masks on a large scale, has really reduced the rates. I mean, the rate of transmission now is very, very low. Look at our region. In St. Louis City and County, where there's been a mandate, you know, we've had, you know, kind of a decline in the growth of COVID infections. We still get a steady amount, but the growth has certainly kind of petered out, and we're kind of at what I would call maybe like a steady state. And, you know, I think with that, and with that policy, and again, we're probably, I'd have to go back and look at the exact dates, but 8 to 10 weeks into that, I think you're starting to see that benefit. It takes a little bit of time. We can start to talk about having students go back to school and think about that. You know, there's been a huge movement about playing sports and having new sports, which I get is very, very important. But I think without having that kind of policy in place of kind of universal face masks, we put ourselves behind. And if you look at Missouri, you know, the metro regions, so Kansas City and St. Louis, you know, who have been pretty, I would say, advanced in implementing policies, particularly around face masks, the rates have, like I said, have been steady. Whereas in outstate Missouri, so areas outside the metro region, the growth rates are really going up and is driving the number of cases in Missouri. And if, you know, if by some analyses, if you look at the New York Times COVID tracker, we're the third fastest growing state in the country. That is not because of St. Louis and is not because of Kansas City. It's because of all the outstate regions out of these metro areas. And again, you got to be a little careful with conclusions here, but, you know, those are generally areas that don't have a widespread face mask policy. And so I think you just have to look at it that way. And I think the director of the CDC is spot on. I think if we did this nationally, if we just buckered down and did it for, say, 3 to 4 months, I think you'd have a much bigger impact than everything else we're hoping on to save us, which is, I think, fool's errand, frankly.
The CDC director, Dr. Redfield, also addressed a vaccine timeline while testifying before Congress.
I think there will be vaccine that initially be available sometime between November and December, but very limited supply and will have to be prioritized. If you're asking me when is it going to be generally available to the American public so we can begin to take advantage of vaccine to get back to our regular life, I think we're probably looking at late second quarter, third quarter, 2021.
Dr. Buckle, what are your thoughts on the vaccine timeline and distribution issues?
Yeah, well, let's at least talk about the positives first, and just the fact that, you know, at the start of this year, basically, or the tail end of 2019, we had the discovery of this new and novel virus, and here we are less than a year later. We've you know, potentially have a vaccine to prevent that, and the what that says about the state of our science and our technology and our know-how is really incredible. This is unbelievably incredible to me how we are able to do this fast, and that's great. That said, the real work of seeing two things: one, does it provide immunity, and two, is it safe, is going on right now. And that just frankly, despite all the speed and rapidity, takes some time, because you have to give people this vaccine and then see what happens to them and make sure not only, again, is it good to prevent the spread of COVID, but is it safe? Is it going to cause significant harm another way, or, you know, worst case scenario, kill as many people as COVID does? And that's, you know, clearly what you want to avoid in doing this. We've got to do that work. So as Dr. Redfield said, you know, best case scenario, we have something viable, ready and safe by the end of the year. But then you have a whole host of distribution questions that are really, I think we've been late to deal with this and lead to a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, just let's look at the example of the high-risk groups and identifying those. Who are they? Some would advocate that they're the patients in a nursing home or the elderly, and there is some truth to that. Some would advocate that, you know, looking at the population, that the Black and Latinx communities have twofold the incidence and mortality of COVID compared to the white community. And are those patients the ones we should intervene in first? And then you add to the complexity of this is how certain we are and how confident we can be in the results of this vaccine, particularly if it's pushed, and particularly if, let's just say, it's not even for political purposes, but there's the perception of political purposes, which I think is inevitable, unfortunately. You know, how do those communities feel about something being pushed on them that might not be safe, or the safety is unknown? And so, you know, we need to make sure that all of our communities feel safe and secure. We as physicians and healthcare policy advocates need to make sure that we do this safely and with some logic. And then last, the big issue is who's going to bear the cost for this. So the government's come out and said nobody is going to be charged to get a COVID vaccine, which is great, but who's going to pay for it? So say I'm in a clinic, or I have my own clinic as a physician, and I've been told to get COVID vaccines for my patients, and I have to front that cost. How do I know I'm going to get paid back for that? How am I supposed to shoulder that alone if my practice is already struggling, which a number of healthcare organizations across the country are dealing with right now? Their margins have been severely affected, and they're losing money. And how do you have those income guarantees? So there's just a lot of big questions that are substantial that haven't been really sorted out yet, and it puts the risk on people that are already vulnerable. And I think we need to make sure we advocate for all those different people that feel vulnerable and make sure they're secure. It's still a very, very difficult logistical problem aside from just manufacturing the product, which also seems to be a logistical problem.
We're talking with our co-host, flu care general internist Dr. Fred Buchholz at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, a couple of new reports this past week. One on obesity at record levels in the United States, above 40%, and the other on uncontrolled hypertension is on the rise throughout America. What's your thinking on that?
Well, and it goes along the same lines with what we're talking about with obesity. This is kind of, you know, kind of a slackening of kind of national measures to deal with this, and I think kind of coincides with the rising rates of obesity and diabetes. And I want to also emphasize too, I think this is also another condition, just like with COVID, that shows, you know, kind of a what I would call a disparity in health outcomes across our population. So I always joke, you know, it's a common theme in St. Louis. We always ask people what high school you go to. And you know, the reason I think we ask that is really you can kind of pigeonhole somebody pretty quickly about where they grew up, what their environment was as they grew up, what their biases are probably as well, too. But there's more truth to that, too, because where you grew up in St. Louis actually predicts your health outcome pretty reliably, more than anything else. And so if you're in a zip code and some of the zip codes in North St. Louis City or county, for instance, compared to a zip code in West St. Louis County, there's a 20-year life expectancy difference between those two zip codes, and they're less than 10 miles away. To me, when I say that, it just seems insane in this country, the richest in the world, that we still are like this, and we have just huge disparities. But again, all these other things percolate with that, you know, access to health care, access to healthy lifestyle choices, access to education, access to jobs. And all that plays into these chronic illnesses, such as hypertension, obesity, and diabetes, of why these rates are higher. And again, this is a societal problem that we have not addressed, and I'm guilty of that as much, if not more, than anybody, perhaps for not advocating for that enough. But it's disturbing to see all of these numbers, obesity, hypertension. It's been very disturbing to see just us be one of the worst countries in the world to deal with the COVID response. As somebody who's dedicated their work and life to dealing with this, it's incredibly frustrating. But I do think we've got to talk as a society, no matter where your background is and your beliefs, is we've got to come up with some policies that, again, don't have much downside harm, but are pretty brainless, that can affect the lives of all of us. And I think that's a good thing and a good conversation that I continue to have and to hope to have.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it every week.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. Appreciate it.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk influenza and COVID-19. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health, on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Experts warn of a possible twindemic, the overlapping of the flu season with an expected surge in COVID-19 cases. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Manu Patry. Dr. Patry is an infectious diseases specialist with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital, Lake St. Louis. Dr. Patry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us more about a possible twindemic.
So as we all know, you know, flu season is upon us, which is very seasonal. You can have the flu any time of the year, but typically flu season will start in around November and go through to about March. And I think because we're so used to the flu, we don't realize how substantial the flu can be. You know, for instance, you know, in 2019 to 2020, there were reported between 24 to 60,000 deaths associated with influenza. And so that in of itself is always a challenge, especially in people who have low immune systems. It's commonly, you know, children are common spreaders, which is why, you know, you see a lot of kids developing the flu, and that's how adults tend to get it. But now with this complication of a pandemic, we do not know what, you know, the future is in store for us. Usually we use data from the Southern Hemisphere to give us some idea of what type of types of strains of the flu that are out there. But we don't really have that, you know, this year because Australia, which is one of the places that we look at, instituted a lot of mandatory masking. And so flu numbers were much lower than what they usually are. What we don't know is how is the U.S. going to respond? Because we don't have a lot of the mandatory masking that other countries do. So not only are we dealing with the challenge of a pandemic with COVID-19, but we also potentially may have the challenge of influenza. So, and then you add the caveat that, you know, as we're seeing by the literature so far, SARS-CoV-2 tends to be spread more through adults and not as much in younger children under 14 as much, while the opposite, where younger children tend to be the spreaders for influenza. So it gets really, really tricky when we're trying to figure out when somebody comes in with, you know, fever, cough, shortness of breath. The question comes down to is that COVID? Is that RSV? Is that influenza? So it becomes a real challenge because there's a lot of overlap in symptoms.
So what could happen if a twindemic occurs?
So the tough part comes down to is this is uncharted territory. The worst case scenario could be that an individual could end up having a severe respiratory illness due to two infections, you know, having influenza and SARS-CoV-2. What we don't know is that could they have a relationship where influenza may be detected based on a test, but you're not actually having influenza, but you have also you're tested positive for COVID-19. The other component is that, you know, as we spoke about, influenza is not in and of itself, any of these respiratory viruses are not very kind to people whose immune systems are very low. And that's also what we're seeing with COVID-19. So our fear is that the risk for, you know, complications with either both, or could it be that you develop influenza, which puts you at risk for getting another infection, which is definitely can happen, but could that second infection be COVID-19 or the opposite? So higher risk for mortality, higher risk for hospitalization, higher risk for complications. That's where our biggest concern is.
We're talking with Dr. Manu Patry. She's an infectious diseases specialist with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in Lake St. Louis about a possible twindemic, a mixture of the flu season hitting an increase in COVID-19 cases. Dr. Patry, does the flu vaccine help in any way protect against COVID-19?
No, they are two separate viruses. The hope that we have, I believe that this is probably one of the most important years, you know, in my knowledge, that the vaccine actually is much more vital because of, you know, to reduce the complications of influenza, which may subsequently lead to other complications with COVID-19. Why I think the vaccine itself has no activity against it, but the intent is it prevents you from getting an infection that could put you at risk for getting another infection. So, and what I think people don't get with the flu is that, you know, the flu vaccine, even if you develop influenza after getting the flu vaccine, it can actually reduce the risk for complications, reduce the risk for hospitalization. It makes it actually helps reduce the severity of this illness. And in a situation like this, where we're already dealing with the complications of a pandemic, trying anything we can to minimize other secondary infections is huge. That's why even outside of the flu vaccine, you know, making sure people are getting up to date with their other vaccines, like the pneumonia vaccine, shingles vaccine, any of that kind of stuff to try to help reduce complications from these infections.
Who should get a vaccine?
Actually, you know, recommendation is, you know, from children from 6 months and up. I would recommend pretty much anybody, unless there's a true contraindication, I would recommend everybody getting it. And where we see, when we see the flu, invariably it usually starts around November. So, you know, getting the flu shot too early also is not a good idea, because you can see the flu pop up in November, and then you tend to see the flu pop up again in January and February. So getting the flu shot too early may not actually give you protection later down, you know, in the beginning of the new year.
So when should you get a flu shot to maximize protection?
So we would typically recommend mid-October to near the end of October. After receiving a flu shot, it takes about 2 weeks for the body to start to develop antibodies. And if the flu season starts around end of October to beginning of November, that we're hoping is the biggest bang for their buck.
So you would suggest waiting a few weeks?
I would actually say mid-October to end of October would be probably better than that, because, you know, again, November time is when the flu starts approximately. So kind of doing, and this is actually, they interviewed Anthony Fauci about this, and that's actually when he tends to get it. And in general, if you talk to infectious disease docs, we usually get it mid-October to end of October.
Does having COVID-19 protect you at all against getting the flu?
There isn't any clear evidence of that. But what could happen is with, as with any viruses, developing a viral infection could put you at risk for other infections. So it's actually not a protective, but it could actually, you know, put you at risk for more infections. So with the flu, we see sometimes the complications of someone develops the flu, and then they can develop, which is a virus, and then develop a bacterial infection afterwards. So it actually can weaken your immune system to put you at risk for other infections. And now in the setting of SARS-CoV-2, what we're also seeing is that the after effects of that virus can continue to linger for months in some people, where they can have resulting heart problems, persistent lung problems. You know, we don't actually know how long these symptoms could actually last.
Dr. Patry, anything else you want to add?
I would say that, you know, I think the most important thing is safety first. You know, wearing a mask, I think, is vital. That the importance also is that it's not just about you. It's about everybody around you. You may have a mild case of COVID-19 or influenza, but your family member whose immune system is low or their friend may not have that luxury. And so there are consequences for our own actions, that it's not just about us. I just want to make sure that people realize it takes a village to definitely get past this. I think everyone's got COVID fatigue, which I don't blame. And now we're talking about now the flu, which I think everyone is just so sick of it all. But the more people who mask and the more people who do social distancing, the less chance for this to spread. And the hope would be that we could eventually get to a point where, you know, we can move past this and get back to some semblance of normalcy.
Dr. Patry, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And thank you for asking me to speak.
Dr. Manu Patry is an infectious diseases specialist with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital, Lake St. Louis. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll get the latest on colon cancer screening. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The American Cancer Society reports its colorectal cancer signs and symptoms page on its website went from 985 visits in the weekend before the death of 43-year-old actor Chadwick Boseman to more than 80,000 the following weekend. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Charlene Prather. Dr. Prather is a slew care gastroenterologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Prather, good to talk to you again.
Absolutely a pleasure. It's certainly one of my favorite things to talk about because it's such an important topic to get out there.
So what do we need to know? What new awareness is there out there?
I think the most important thing we need to know is that colon cancer is preventable and that we have excellent screening tests to prevent colon cancer. I think the other important thing to recognize is that we have moved the bar as to when colon cancer screening should start. We're all remembering that, oh, at age 50, I need to get my colonoscopy. Well, we've moved that earlier because of these changes, and we are now recommending that screening begin at the age of 45 for average-risk individuals.
Is that because we're seeing younger cases of colon cancer these days?
You absolutely nailed it. We have made great strides in reducing colon cancer in individuals over the age of 55. However, there's been a 2% increase in colon cancer in individuals under the age of 45. So the American Cancer Society more recently has recommended dropping that screening age down to the age of 45. And there's an important reason for that. We know that when colon cancer is detected early, it is much more curable, and that's going to happen at a younger age. The other thing is that if you have a colonoscopy, that is not only for detecting colon cancer, but is actually for preventing colon cancer. When we remove polyps, we reduce the subsequent risk of developing a cancer later on.
Who should be screened before age 45?
Before the age of 45, if you have a first-degree relative with colon cancer, you likely need to be screened earlier. Also, if there are multiple family members with cancers, which may not just be colon cancer, but other cancers such as uterine cancer, bladder cancer, you may need to be screened a bit earlier too. If you have an underlying inflammatory bowel disease, earlier screening is in order. We are also moving towards taking a look at other risk factors. They're a little bit softer. We don't have hard recommendations on when to start, but you should talk to your physician or other primary care provider. And that's if you have risk factors such as being a bit overweight, inactive, smoking, alcohol use. Those are modifiable risk factors, but if you have them, you may be at greater risk. This is particularly true of our patients who have type 2 diabetes mellitus. Those individuals are also at a greater risk for colon cancer, and it may be appropriate to be screened a bit earlier.
What about the African-American community?
Previously, we had been recommending that individuals who are African-American be screened beginning at the age of 45. We've now moved that down to everyone. We aren't currently recommending screening earlier than age 45 for African-Americans. Everyone should be screened at age 45 and, you know, after that. However, if you have other risk factors or symptoms that suggest colon cancer, you should be screened sooner. Those symptoms can include a change in bowel habit, rectal bleeding, feeling like you need to empty your bowels, but they just won't quite empty, anemia that's unexplained. So there are other reasons when earlier screening should happen. Why doesn't that happen? Well, sometimes people think, oh, I've got a little bit of rectal bleeding. It must be my hemorrhoids. Well, certainly hemorrhoids can cause bleeding, but so does early colon cancer. And so don't just assume that bleeding is related to hemorrhoids. Check with your doctor, check with your primary care provider, and make sure that it doesn't warrant a sooner screening for you.
We're talking with Dr. Charlene Prather. Dr. Prather is a SLU care gastroenterologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Prather, what's the impact of colon cancer on the African-American community?
Well, the impact of colon cancer and many other cancers are absolutely significant in the African-American community. For example, they tend to be diagnosed a bit later. And when you're diagnosed later, your likelihood of having a cure becomes much lower. We know that when colon cancer is caught early, before it's spread, that your five-year survival rate is well greater than 90% or more. However, once it's already spread, when we get out to that five-year survival rate, it becomes quite a bit lower. For example, in individuals with more distant colon cancer, your likelihood of surviving at 5 years is only 14%. And unfortunately, that has been something that we see more commonly in individuals that are younger because they tend to put off going to their physicians for symptoms because they assume that they're too young to have colon cancer. We also know that individuals that are African American may have less access to health care. So even though they may have symptoms, having access to get that care and to get that testing may not happen. Unfortunately, there are many different reasons why underrepresented minorities do not get the health care that they need. And it's something that we certainly need to focus on more as a society and certainly as a healthcare community.
Dr. Prather, are there any good alternatives to the traditional colonoscopy that you would recommend?
Absolutely. Well, obviously, as a gastroenterologist, I'm a big fan of colonoscopy. However, I want people to get screened, whether it's with a colonoscopy or another modality. Other opportunities are fecal immunochemical tests. This is a more specialized test that looks at blood in the stool. That needs to be done every year. There's also a stool DNA test that goes by the brand name of Cologuard, and this tests not just for blood in the stool, but genetic changes that suggest the development of advanced polyps or cancer. That needs to be done every 3 years. CT colonography is not done quite as commonly as it used to be, but is still an alternative that's out there. And flexible sigmoidoscopy, which is looking just at the left side of the colon and doesn't examine the entire colon, is also another opportunity for screening and must be done every 5 years.
And once you've been found to have colon cancer, it's no longer a death sentence, is it?
Absolutely not. We have made amazing advances in the treatment and management of colon cancer. So you are likely to need surgery because that's currently what's curative for colon cancer. But some of the different modalities we have with chemotherapy have become quite effective at controlling colon cancer. So absolutely, don't assume that because you have colon cancer that you're going to die from colon cancer. Get the best treatment possible out there, and you can live a long and healthy life.
Any lifestyle changes we should make trying to avoid colon cancer?
Well, the lifestyle changes are ones that are good for us all around. Maintaining a healthy weight, being active, don't smoke, don't drink alcohol, avoid red meat, avoid processed meats, and really eat those fruits and vegetables. We believe that about half of individuals who develop colon cancer actually have modifiable risk factors. So diet certainly is important. Being active is important, and just taking good care of yourself.
Dr. Prather, anything else you want to get out there?
Get yourself screened. We would be happy to have everyone getting in line to get their colon cancer screening. If there's anything that we can do to help convince you, we would love to talk to you.
Dr. Prather, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Dr. Charlene Prather is a SLU care gastroenterologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about the dangers that some hand sanitizers may pose to kids. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The FDA continues to warn consumers about certain kinds of hand sanitizers that could be dangerous. Here to talk with us about that is Julie Weber. Julie is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. She's also president of the American Association of Poison Control Centers. Julie, good to talk to you again. What's got poison centers so concerned?
So the concern with the recall on these hand sanitizers are that they contain a type of alcohol that is much more dangerous than what's approved to go in these. Typically, in the hand sanitizers that we're using, it has isopropyl or ethyl alcohol, and the ones that have been recalled that can be a high risk contain methyl alcohol or methanol.
Tell me about the dangers of these.
So the dangers of this is something similar I talk about. Methyl alcohol is also in windshield washer solution, and methyl alcohol can actually, in like a mouthful in a child or an adult, can cause blindness. So it's a type of alcohol that when it gets into our bodies, how it metabolizes is it can hurt a number of organ systems, but it can also directly affect our vision.
So how do you know if you're getting a good or a bad hand sanitizer?
So right now, fortunately, we haven't seen a lot of these products in the Missouri area, but the best way to know is by to stick with the brand names if they're available. If those brand names aren't available and you're buying something that is not something you're used to using, you really need to go to that FDA website, and it's right up there on their homepage as you look for the recall for hand sanitizers. And there are certain brands that by the number on the package or the brand name, you can compare to see if it's a problem.
What are some of the signs and symptoms parents should be on the lookout for?
So what happens is very much, it's not if it's just on their skin. I mean, we do not recommend it, but just like a one-time use on the skin is not going to cause absorption. If a child or an adult would ingest this, like drink enough of it, initially it could cause some nausea or vomiting or maybe drowsiness, and that's what we're really going to look for in any kind of hand sanitizer product. If a child's ingested it and they're acting more drowsy, not their normal behavior, hard to wake up, that's something we immediately want anyone to call the poison center, but also a concern that they may need to go to the emergency department.
What's the number for the poison center?
The number's 1-800-222-1222.
Have you been receiving reports of kids actually swallowing some hand sanitizers?
Definitely our numbers are up nationally. The numbers for kids ingesting hand sanitizers is up 75%. But in Missouri alone, we've seen, I believe it's about a 25 to 30% increase. So a lot of our exposures are by dermal, but because they're so accessible in our homes and often with some of this packaging, the really kind of attractive scents like cherry, bubblegum, children are grabbing these and taking a drink of it. One small drink with the ethanol-based hand sanitizer, not too big a deal, but if they get larger amounts because they think it's something good, we could run into some other issues.
I think the FDA is also concerned about the packaging, not just the flavors, but there's some packaging that makes it look like a food product or a beverage.
Oh, yes. The packaging is really changing out there, and I've seen examples where they look like the small water bottles, and with the hand sanitizer being clear, adults and children both have mistaken it and taken a drink thinking it's packaged as a bottle of water. Some are packaged by distilleries to look like their vodka or gin product. And then the one that I saw the latest is that they're starting to package some of these in those food pouches, like what we see that we give our kids as a snack. So we really have to really watch that packaging.
We're talking with Julie Weber. Julie is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. She's also the president of the American Association of Poison Control Centers. Julie, how should we store these hand sanitizers around the house?
So we do, of course, want to have them around because as we're being cautious and protecting ourselves. But if you have young children in the home, really it should be an activity where the parent supervises what happens when the product's used. So we really do want to get them high out of their access and if possible yet still available to us, but out of their eyesight because they get very intrigued and curious about them. The other thing is if we really can maybe designate it to like a closet or a shelf, something where if it's not in an area they can climb up or build a little stool to get up there, that's really what we want to do.
Are there any tips for the proper use of hand sanitizers?
I think the proper use is really it doesn't take a large amount. You know, that small dime size amount in the hand. Make sure and watch the child rub their hands together that they're not licking it. But also when we are dispensing it and putting it into their hands, be cautious because sometimes the container spurts. And what we're seeing, too, is that children are getting it into their eyes, and it's extremely irritating to the eyes. So overall, I think when we have our younger children, adult supervision and administration, and then kind of build up as they get older into that grade school age.
Julie, once more, if people want to get hold of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital, what do they need to do?
Yes, our number is 1-800-222-1222. And they'll get either a registered pharmacist or a registered nurse who's specially trained in poison information to be able to answer a question or to help with an exposure.
Julie, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, and I appreciate you getting the word out for safety and prevention.
Julie Weber is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. She's also president of the American Association of Poison Control Centers. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.